Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The first debate of the primary season last week pitched, with first official debate of the primary season last week pitched Democrat against Democrat in the race for governor. They shared opinions on issues ranging from Medicaid expansion and marijuana legalization to gun control, and they traded a fair share of jabs. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jesse Ballmer. Welcome back, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt.
Good morning.
And reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel. Welcome back, Jim.
Good to be here.
Bill O'Neill, the Supreme Court justice and gubernatorial candidate, has said that the election process is rigged in favor of Rich Cordray. What do you make of that? Do you see this as a rig, Jim Siegel?
Well, Rich Cordray's raised the most money. So
if you want to call that rigging,
I don't know that there's been a rigging going on. I mean, some might say that gives the Democratic Party a little too much credit for the ability to pull that off. But Rich Cordray is, when he got in the race, he became the kind of presumptive front runner. That doesn't mean he's going to win, but, you know, the fact that he immediately jumped in and immediately raised $2 million shows that, you know, he has the biggest profile of any of the Democrats in the race at that time and still, and has the biggest ability to raise money. Now, those two things added up make you the front runner. And so, you know, Bill O'Neill, who is not known for holding his tongue, has decided that the way to try to combat that is to try to make it seem like the Democratic Party is setting up Cordray for, you know, has anointed him as the guy. He's hoping that there be some backlash to that and it'll work in his favor.
He's taken yet another policy, made another move on policy. He's said, Jesse Ballmer, that he opposes abortion rights.
Yes. So Bill O'Neill, former Supreme Court justice, said that he is pro-life. But he also said that he would follow federal laws and judgments on abortion. So what I asked him about was, you know, what does that mean by way of policy? Because there are a number of abortion bills that go across the desk of a governor. Like, would he sign something like a bill that would require cremation or burial of fetal remains? Or would he sign something, you know, like the recent ban on abortions after a fetal diagnosis of Down syndrome? And in some instances, he wasn't particularly familiar with the legislation. In other instances, he said, well, I'd have to think about it. So it's hard to really nail down what this pro-life stance means. There have been other Democrats, especially those who are Catholic, like Mr. O'Neill, who have said, you know, I'm not particularly a fan of abortion or don't support it, but have, you know, voted against bills anyway. Notably, Bill Patman from the Cleveland area frequently will sponsor bills that limit abortion access. Denise Driehaus from our area also, she voted, you know, for a 20-week ban on abortion. Again, a lot of times those have to deal with, like, personal faith.
Mm-hmm. What other issues came out of the debate that were notable?
Gun violence, gun control, that you know, Dennis Kucinich is making that a big issue because it's one where he believes he can really differentiate himself from the other candidates. Richard Cordray got a one-time A rating from the NRA. He was the attorney general when Ohio passed and defended a law that basically took away local entities' powers to pass local gun control measures. That has kind of emerged as a major issue in that primary, just because the candidates do have different positions, different histories that come into play. Dennis Kucinich has called for an assault weapons ban. Joe Schiavone, another, you know, the fourth candidate that we haven't mentioned yet, he has taken a more nuanced position and said that he's interested in school safety and some other measures. So, I think that was probably going to be a topic in this primary, but has really emerged as a top four or five just because of the recent events in Florida.
Right. Cordray has an A rating from the NRA so far. He's made no effort to distance himself from them. How much is that going to come into play in this race?
So I think it's going to be hard. I think right now there is a lot of discussion about guns because of recent shootings. It'll be interesting whether there is this continued attention to this through May and then also through November if Cordray is the nominee. So it's sometimes not an issue that people vote on per se, especially gun control as opposed to like Second Amendment rights are much more enthusiastic voters and organized voters. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, whether the students speaking out in Florida is something that's going to move voters by November.
And around the country. I mean, there's walkouts planned for later in March, student walkouts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, traditionally, and I'm talking about the last probably 20 years, the gun issue has been a much bigger deal in Republican primaries than it has been in Democratic primaries. There is a reason why the NRA is so powerful, and it's not just money. It's because they have a lot of voters or a lot of members and a lot of voters in their ranks that vote based almost solely on this issue. The Democrats do not have that to nearly the degree on their side that vote simply because they want to see you enact more gun control. As we were saying here earlier, this could become a bigger issue because of what's happened. This could change, and we'll wait. I guess we'll have to wait and see in May if that does have any effect, because Rich Cordray is clearly of the four running is clearly the one who has the most support from the NRA in the past and has the biggest record when it comes to being supportive of this Second Amendment and opposing gun control provisions. So will that play out in the Democratic primary and make a difference? You know, we'll see.
Yeah. A recent example of this was actually the U.S. Senate race, where Cincinnati Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld made guns almost his sole issue in his primary against Ted Strickland, who also had
for good, U.S. Senate. Right?
For U.S. Senate, Ted Strickland, former governor, had also received the backing of gun groups, even over John Kasich when they were head to head for the governor's race. And I think P.G. Sittenfeld had some other struggles, lack of name recognition, et cetera. But running on just this one issue, you know, didn't really get him the support to make it competitive with Strickland in the primary for U.S. Senate.
It's a tricky deal. I mean, it's maybe a little tougher in the Democratic primary, although, as you have said, Jim, Democrats typically don't vote on that issue. But it could put a Rich Cordray candidate in a much stronger position in a general election because of his A rating.
Well, he's got a couple. There's a couple folks in the race, you know, O'Neill and Kucinich, who are running at him from the left.
Right.
You've got O'Neill, and he wants full marijuana legalization. That's not something that Cordray's been behind. Kucinich wants to do things like ban all drilling.
Fracking.
And not even just fracking. Yeah. All drilling.
It, yeah.
So he is getting pushed from the left, and that is – that will be interesting to see if he is if he feels like he needs to move that direction a little bit or not.
To
get through the primary. I don't know what the polling numbers show for him. I think it's it'll be telling if you start seeing him come out with some more positions, maybe moving a little bit more in that direction. But I have no idea where things stand. But I know you got to do well up in the Cleveland, Northeast Ohio area in a Democratic primary, or you're not going to have a whole lot of success.
All the candidates support the Medicaid expansion that was, you know, created by the current governor. But Rich Cordray questioned whether or not the state can afford it. He started to raise a little bit of a flag there as far as his support for that.
Well, I mean, Medicaid is the biggest chunk of the state budget.
Right.
Containing costs in the area are always a concern. And that's something that, you know, Governor Kasich has said is a priority of his during his time. And partially that's, you know, an argument for expanding Medicaid because it's a deal right now for the state. But of course, with the President Trump administration, there's a little bit more uncertainty about what you know, the feds might fund as a portion of that. Right now, they're funding most of it, and you know, for Ohio, it's eventually going to drop down to what 10% of the funding from the state and 90% from the feds. But that all could change. There's a big, you know, question mark there.
Right.
Yeah, I guess a question on that too is, what to what end are you making the point that we're going to have trouble affording it? Is it because you're advocating for somehow cut it, you know, scaling that back? Are you advocating for raising more revenue so that the state can afford it? Are you advocating for other changes to the Medicaid program and so that it just costs less? I mean, it some of that needs to be fleshed out before you can just say, you know, make the argument that we're going to have a hard time affording this because, I mean, look, the state of Ohio's had a hard time affording Medicaid for 30 years, and that's not going to change just because of expansion. It hasn't changed. And so the question is, what do you do to address it, and what route are you looking to take?
And I think that, you know, raises a good point that this is the first debate. I mean, the Democrats have had this is the fourth debate technically, but it's the first one where you had Cordray and Kucinich and O'Neill up there with Joe Schiavone.
And Joe Schiavone, by the way, had to make the point that his lack of name recognition doesn't affect him. What does he bring to the table? How do you think he'll fare?
I mean, his lack of name recognition does affect him.
Yeah, I mean, name recognition is everything.
To that point, I mean, Mike DeWine has the best name recognition of anyone on either side, and everyone else is probably playing catch up to a certain extent. I'm not sure how much name recognition Rich Cordray has from being attorney general in 2010 or Dennis Kucinich has from his presidential bids or what have you. But I think Joe Schiavone brings to the race. I mean, he is younger than the other candidates. He is a person who is actively in government right now, as opposed to someone who hasn't been in state government for several years. And so I think he's also spoken a lot about charter schools and education.
That's right.
His lieutenant governor candidate, Stephanie Dodd, is on the State Board of Education. And so is kind of bringing that record of doing something about it recently to the race that perhaps some of the other candidates don't have. But he's not well known across the state, and he isn't raising the kind of money that some of the other candidates are. And those are going to be challenges for him.
I will say, I think the Democrats make a huge mistake, though, if Joe Schiavone doesn't emerge from this primary victorious and the Democrats just kind of let him fade away. I mean, he comes from an area of the state that where the Democrats need to start figuring out how to better talk to voters. It's an area of the state that Donald Trump did very well in, up in northern eastern Ohio, Youngstown area. And when I say very well, I mean, he almost won Mahoning County.
Which is a Democratic stronghold.
Stronghold. And then, you know, he won by a ton in the counties just to the south. Up there along the Ohio River. So Joe Schiavone has an ability to talk to those type of voters. He knows how to connect to them. He has a certain style, a certain kind of, you know, he's a former boxer. He knows how to get in the ring and duke it, you know, mix it up on these kind of issues, the way that folks like that over in those areas like to hear it. And, they should, I mean, but at the end of the day, he is going to, you know, it's a big hump to get over to, you know, with the name recognition and all that. So even if he doesn't make it, I think the Democrats should probably try to find a way to keep him in the fold somehow.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. Coming up, we're going to talk about the State of the State address last week, such as it was. My guests, Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, state government reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jesse Ballmert, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt, and reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel. Let's talk about the State of the State address last week. It was unusual. If you dropped in a little late, as did I wasn't exactly sure what was going on. It was sort of a treatise on philosophy without ever actually saying anything about the philosophical stances of Socrates and Plato and Kierkegaard. But it was interesting. What'd you make of it, Jesse Ballmert?
So this was Governor John Kasich's last State of the State speech, and I think he just wanted, like, Kasich being Kasich. So he spoke a lot about the values that Ohio needed going forward and not a lot about what he had accomplished as governor, like specifics or about what they're going to do in the next 10 months as far as policies. The only kind of new information was we're going to get a state park in the Muskingum-Morgan County area and that we're going to put a little more money towards a mental health facility building in the Columbus area. So it was odd. He said it would be odd, and it lived up to the billing.
It was odd. A lot of his State of the State addresses have been odd for one reason or another. But this one didn't review the year.
If you were expecting a State of the State address, you were disappointed. It did not necessarily give a state of the state. It didn't, like Jesse said, didn't give any, you know, details on policies. And afterward, the next morning I was thinking, what could he have said? You know, as a lame duck with only, 10 months left, with a legislature, Republican legislature, that doesn't really, fall in step with everything he wants to do. Typically he's used that as kind of a bully pulpit to champion, praise the things he's done and the legislature as well. And also, if he's going to introduce a budget, he'll, tout some things he wants to see go through in the budget. I think people were expecting him to at least tout the gun policy changes that his, bipartisan commission had rolled out just the week before. And there was, not really a mention of that. There was a national kind of mention of the issue. I think it left a lot of other politicians who were present and political observers kind of confused and puzzled.
Didn't give the Democrats a lot to chew on, Jim Siegel.
No, didn't give anybody much to chew on except the Democrats basically said, look, I really wish he would have started, would have talked more about the issues that are still plaguing the state. We still have an opioid and a drug overdose crisis. We still have, we have gun policy that has not passed. We've got a job situation that isn't quite where it should be and et cetera, et cetera. But I guess in this age of divisive politics, he was trying to appeal to everybody's better nature and, urge folks to help others and willingness to look beyond yourselves and all that stuff. There wasn't much meat to it. I mean, as reporters, when we cover a speech like this, we like, surprise. We actually like news to come out of these things. And news was very scarce in this speech. So it was, a lot of reflection and a lot of, talk of what guides him in life and in his policies, but not really much about anything policy related.
It's more the state of the state of maybe John Kasich's mind.
what did that tell us then?
Well, and I think, you could look at it as a way of, political divisiveness is at the root of all sorts of problems that we face. The job issue and all of these things are bottlenecked by that. And I think that's probably pretty, admirable if that's what you're going to give your speech on. But, Anne, you said you tuned in late and you were confused. I think even if you watched from the beginning, people were confused. It as a speech, just as written, and given orally device, it just didn't work. It was clunky. It jumped around a lot. I think it would have benefited from having more direction, more, this is in the terms of, what Jim was saying, classic Kasich. His first day of State of the State speech was totally off the cuff and all over the map. And that's kind of what we saw here. And I think it would have helped by having some more structure in it, you know, giving more examples. You know, I'm a liberal arts graduate. I picked up on the philosophical references, but
I
most
kept waiting
people,
for why are you saying
but,
these
but
names?
Exactly. But then how do you connect them? And before I was trying to connect them in my head, and then he was on to the next thing. So, you know, it's hard to follow. And I think, you know, he was very... It was very, you could tell in the way he was delivering it, very heartfelt, and he was speaking from his heart as well as his mind. But the things just, the dots just weren't connecting, and that's a huge stumbling block to getting your message across. Anyone who's taken Speech 101 knows that if you can't deliver it effectively, then, you know, you don't really get your message
through. You know, we talked about this last week after the State of the State, and we had some callers say who like John Kasich, you know, and Republicans say they liked the speech. They liked it was upbeat, and it was like, you know, speaking to people's better selves and that kind of a thing, and they thought it worked.
Okay, well, if that's what if you're fine with getting that out of the speech, I didn't hear, you know, most people, even the Democrats weren't saying, well, we disagree with him. I mean, he was saying a lot of nice things about, you know, doing better, you know, go forth and do better for society, which is nice, you know, a message that very few are going to disagree with. Mm-hmm. But it's a matter of, all right, well, what are you going to do to do that? Talking about it is one thing, doing it is another. And that's where I think the folks who really want to hear that kind of thing out of a speech like this. This wasn't just John Kasich riffing in the, you know, in some random speech. I mean, this is State of the State. This is the one speech he gets every year where he has a big captive audience and he's expected
of legislators. I mean, he's speaking.
Right, he's speaking to the legislature.
Of the House, a joint session of the House and Senate. So, I mean, that's who the speech is directed to. I mean, it's, of course, you know, developed into this, you know, huge theatrical event where he's taking it to different parts of the state, and, you know, he gives out these courage awards at the end. So it's turned into a community event in these places where it's held. It's televised. It's over the radio. So it has become a bigger event. But yeah, at the heart of it, it's the policymakers who are there. You know, that's his audience, his core audience.
And to Jackie's point earlier, we were talking, he spoke a lot about, oh, there's been this shooting incident in this part of the country, or he talked about the courage of the Parkland students speaking up, or we gave out a courage award to a person who helped out in the Las Vegas shooting who was from the Miamisburg area, mm-hmm. and yet stopped short of actually talking about the policies that he had introduced just 1 week before
right.
to perhaps address some of these things. And so I think that's where Democrats afterward were like, yes, but, and perhaps where reporters were saying, yeah, these are good ideas, but what does that mean for the state of Ohio?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor tweeted out a one word response to the tweet or to the speech.
Right.
And it was simply, huh.
Right.
That was it. That's what she tweeted out. It was, huh. So that, so if you're wondering what she thought of it, that was.
Or really no mention of redistricting reform, which, mm-hmm. you know, was a right. very bipartisan effort and perhaps in line with many of the right. ideals that the governor was talking about. And we were just toasting the week before with Austrian schnapps and Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it seemed like a good moment to perhaps mention that. But I didn't see a lot of time spent on that topic either.
At the end, resolved that Ohio is back. And I thought that was odd. Back from where? Actually, it's stagnated by some measures. I didn't know what he was saying. If he just says it, then it makes it true. I didn't know. What did you guys make of the Ohio is back thing? He's not running for anything yet, technically.
I don't know. I don't know what he, you know, when you, you know, he's in his last.
Sorry, listeners, my panel's not being very.
Well, no, he's in his. I mean, it's one thing to say we're back in your third State of the State speech,
right. Which he did.
Which he did.
Yeah.
And probably in his fourth and fifth as well. You know, this is the
You're
last.
Out of the ditch.
You know, this is, he's in his eighth year now. I think
Ohio's still back.
I think if you want to make the case we're back, then maybe we should have been back before. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's just something you say to try to get in a, you know, fire some people up a little bit at the end.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard from Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Jesse Ballmer of the Cincinnati Enquirer and Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com. Columbus Democrat Senator Charlita Tavares introduced a bill last week to address the Ohio General Assembly sexual harassment policies. She's been kind of busy lately. She says the current policies don't encourage reports of sexual encourage reporting of sexual harassment, and she said that her bill would be a step toward changing that. What she's a Democrat in a decisively Republican controlled Senate, and even more Republican controlled House. What's she up to here?
Well, I mean, it's pretty telling that her bill doesn't have any Republican co-sponsors at this moment. I mean, she makes a good point that this is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. You know, in the last 8 months or so, we've had several, you know, incidents at the State House of, quote unquote, inappropriate behavior, including, you know, a complaint that was made against a former a state senator at the time, a Republican, that on, you know, some 8 or 9 instances, he was, you know, badgering a woman who worked in another state department. So that's probably the most detailed instance we have. But, you know, the Democratic the Senate Democrats chief of staff resigned soon after that. We've had people in the House resign or get, you know, punished for inappropriate, you know, behavior. So it's I think she makes a good point there. What's interesting is that the response from Senate President Obstoff's office was, you know, that they're not certain that there needs to be some changes, that they deal with things as they come up and they deal with them correctly and they, you know, move on. But on the other side of the State House over in the House, House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger has said that, you know, he kind of assembled a group, a task force to kind of look at this issue. And he had said last week that he expects they will make some sort of policy recommendations. And that could be specific to the House. It could be, you know, some sort of guidelines for all state agencies. You know, he's kind of given them a lot of room to look at the subject and see what needs to be done. I know a couple months ago, I looked at the policies in the House and the Senate, and they both call for reports to be made to, you know, staffers within the House and the Senate, the chief of staff or, you know, a chief administrative officer within the chamber. And yeah, I talked to some political scientists who, you know, kind of specialize in this area, and they were said that raises some red flags right off the bat that, you know, reporting to someone who's close to a legislator or someone with power, mm-hmm. or what if you're reporting that, you know, that chief of staff or that staffer that you're supposed to report to, it's not really it doesn't really give a lot of avenues for reporting. I know one thing that Senator Tavares, and it's not in her bill, but Senator Tavares and Representative Antonio in the House have said they're looking at where else could you report that so that it's not just kept in-house. And I believe the bill that was introduced last week would actually have the legislative inspector general's office have someone in there that would handle all the complaints. So at least it's not someone with a
who works for your boss
or or, you know, the boss. So that you know, this bill raises that question. Essentially what her bill does is it would require the House, the Senate, the Capitol Square Review and Advisory Board, which is the agency that looks over the State House and runs everything in the State House, Highway Patrol. And then, interestingly enough, all of the lobbyists and companies that lobby at the State House to have sexual harassment policies on the books that meet certain guidelines to be determined by a task force.
Task force.
I know. And how many times have I said that in the last 5 minutes? But a task force with, you know, Republicans, Democrats, staffers, you know, a group of legislative folks saying, you know, this is the kind of atmosphere we want to create at the State House, recognizing that all of those people work there. You have, because it's not just legislators. There's all the staffers that work with legislators. There's interns, pages, lobbyists. So, you know, it's kind of taking the look of what kind of culture do we want to have at the State House and how do we go about doing that? And so that group that her bill would put together would then kind of make some general recommendations. But
And I, after this bill was discussed, I spoke with a professor of law at Ohio State University who looks at kind of employment policies and so forth. And she said, you know, policies on harassment and training on preventing harassment are important, but sometimes people tend to tune them out. And that was some concern that perhaps lawmakers weren't paying attention to the training because they got in trouble for some comments shortly thereafter. And she said, the real critical thing is when something happens, is it taken seriously and is the person adequately penalized for it? Like, do they lose a position? Are they asked to resign? And those are kind of the key issues in that. And one of the challenges for state lawmakers is it's really the voters who are their bosses as far as whether they get to stay there or not. The speaker or the Senate president are not able to fire a lawmaker. They can just say
they can change their committee assignments. Though,
they can change
like that.
Their committee assignments. They can take them off leadership, but they can't, you know, kick them out unless they're convicted of a felony.
Right.
So it is a problem where, you know, you can bring them into the office and say, I strongly suggest that you resign. This is going to be bad for you. But they don't have like ultimate authority.
Yeah, I think I think there is some key things here. Is that it, one of the key things is where do you report this? I think Jackie was absolutely right that is a key part of this. If you look at the one instance where the state senator was basically told you need to get out, and he did, that it was an instance where the person who was harassed worked for a different agency, worked for the Legislative Service Commission, and therefore she was able to report to the Legislative mm-hmm. Service Commission, not to the legislature. And so the Legislative Service Commission, which is basically the legal arm of the legislature, they took it very seriously. They did a report. They got the Legislative Inspector General involved. Mm-hmm. And so that quickly led to Senator Heitz, stepping down and under duress. So that is the kind of I do agree that is probably the key thing, is making sure, especially in the legislature, that these folks have a place to go where they feel like they can actually tell their story and not have retribution come back on them by others in power. Because, I mean, look, you could talk about the sexual harassment training. And mm-hmm. as we just said, there was this incident where the House had sexual harassment training. And then literally the next day is when this incident happened on Capitol Square, where there was a party for a going away party in which there was some inappropriate things said, including someone making light of the situation involving Senator Height. So, I mean, I have a hard, you know, as the man in the room, let's just say, I have a hard time believing that if you watching a 1 hour PowerPoint presentation on sexual harassment for someone who habitually does harass women is going to suddenly be enlightened by that. I mean, that you can do that and we should be doing that. But I don't know that in and of itself is going to change the culture. What's going to change the culture is when you're going to have these things taken seriously, as we have seen, the more seriously these allegations are being taken, both in Ohio and around the nation, the more this has become a real issue, and that's how things change.
What have the repercussions been for Bill Seitz, State Rep. Bill Seitz, from the Cincinnati area since that event at that going away party? He was one of the people that made inappropriate remarks, and I think Cliff Rosenberger, the House Speaker, has said nothing.
Yeah, I mean, he was asked to apologize to the current female lawmaker and a former female lawmaker about his comments, but he's still a member of leadership. He hasn't lost any particular positions over the comments.
No ramifications. We'll continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. With us, Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com, Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. And still with us from the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jesse Ballmert, from the Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt, and from the Columbus Dispatch, Jim Siegel. We have an email from Brady. He says, why doesn't anyone on your panel ever say anything good about Kasich? Is it just because he's a Republican? Seems to me like Kasich is a good guy and smart. I'm a Democrat and don't think he's a bad guy. Now, I don't think anybody says he's a bad guy, but what do you guys say? Why are you always trashing John Kasich?
My job isn't to say good things about John Kasich. My job isn't to say is just to, you know, report the news and give you some analysis of what I see.
Right.
Yeah, and I think along in those veins, being critical of our leaders is important. It's an important part of what we do, and it just so happens that all of our elected statewide officials are Republicans.
Yeah.
And the Republicans also control both chambers, and so
I get this complaint
every
scrutiny.
Once in a while
from readers
as well. If it were a Democrat, you'd do this, or why don't you, report what the Democrats are doing? And quite honestly, because the Democrats aren't the ones that are making the decisions, and
they're making zero decisions,
right?
And I think a lot of times it's important to point out John Kasich's record in a way that sometimes you might not get on a national level where they're just less aware or familiar with his record. There was some comments he made on national news recently about, wanting to move forward on gun control and present common sense gun policies. And I think a lot of Ohio reporters pointed out his record on guns in Ohio and what bills he has signed and hasn't signed. And so I think it's important to report what he says, but also important to report what he does. And I think that's a complaint that people hear up and down, at a national level and at a local level. So I think we're just trying to provide some context, and we're not saying John Kasich is the worst governor in Ohio or anything like that.
It has been so long since Democrats have had any semblance of control. It probably does feel that way. Back in the day, 100 years ago, when I was covering the General Assembly, Democrats shared control of the Ohio General Assembly. They usually controlled the House. Republicans controlled the Senate, but even then, there were many more Democrats in the Senate. When they would vote on things, they had to actually work on policy and they had to compromise. Now it's all fully in control of Republicans. There's no question.
I think what Brady's really asking is that John Kasich appear on your show.
And by the way, John Kasich won't come on my show. I don't know why. He's always welcome. I hope it would be really great to get him on before the end of his second term in office. So I don't know what those national news programs have that I don't have. Anyways, Brady, thanks a lot for your email. We appreciate it. Thanks for listening. Over the weekend, there was a pro-gun rally. There's supposed to be some anti-gun rights rallies coming up in March. This was a pro-gun. They attracted an estimated 1,000 supporters and a Republican gubernatorial candidate. And Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor was on hand with her own shotgun. Let's hear from David in Hilliard right now. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just thought it was outrageous to see Mary Taylor or any politician standing up there and saying to establishment politicians that aren't going to protect our gun rights, well, come and take it. I mean, to me, that was subtly advocating violence. I mean, if a politician wants to stand up there and say, vote for me, or you need to vote for more conservative, as divided as our country is now and as high strung as the gun advocates are, to stand up there and basically be saying, advocating violence, I was shocked. It reminded me of a few years ago when we saw the videos of Saddam Hussein shooting the shotguns in the air. I mean, I was outraged.
Mary Taylor has been, thank you so much, David, has been front and center, pro-gun rights advocate. She's carried her gun before in advertisements and that kind of a thing, and campaign ads and so forth. She has been unapologetic. She looked right at home up there. No surprise.
Well, and politically, it speaks to a constituency. And while your caller may have been alarmed, another segment of Ohio voters may have, you know, raised their guns at home to, you know, in support of that. This issue, like we talked about earlier with the Democrats, it is a perennial issue in the Republican primary. And it's one of many where Mary Taylor's positioning herself to the right of Mike DeWine, and really without much much clamor from the DeWine camp. They're trying to kind of keep a low profile when it comes to Mary Taylor's criticism. And she, you know, when she said establishment, she mentioned Mike DeWine by name. Mm-hmm. She mentioned John Kasich by name, who is actually her...
Has endorsed her,
right? So, you know, I... She didn't do anything legal. It's legal to have your rifle out and in the open. And
but she did make that comment, sort of come and get it.
I think that's
what David was kind of shocked about. It seemed like kind of inviting violence or inviting conflict.
Perhaps conflict, yeah. I'm not sure how much you need to read into whether this was inciting violence or anything like that. But much like on the Democratic side, guns are an issue. On the Republican side, this is an area where Mary Taylor feels like she can go to the right of Mike DeWine, who, you know, in 2006 was endorsed by the Brady campaign to prevent gun violence in his U.S. Senate race. And so he has a history of... perhaps some gun control stances. And she feels like if I can appeal to the people who, you know, are true Second Amendment rights people, you know, I can grab those votes per se. And I don't think it's ingenuine to her previous stances or anything like that. But right after John Kasich came out with some plans to address gun control, she was, you know, immediately opposing those, saying that they would be ways to take guns without due process. And so she sees this as an issue that she can appeal to those voters that feel comfortable with raising a gun in front of the state house.
Mm-hmm. Well, and look, to actually hold up your rifle and say, come and get it, to John Kasich and Mike DeWine.
Yeah.
I mean, look, as someone who's covered politics for a lot of years, that just sounds utterly ridiculous that John Kasich and Mike DeWine would be trying to take your rifle away from you. I mean, you know, John Kasich has proposed banning bump stocks, which turn semi-automatic weapons into automatic weapons. He's proposed banning large magazine clips that allow people to shoot a lot more bullets without having to reload. I mean, he's talking about those kind of things. He's not talking about getting rid of the rifle that's in your hand that you're holding up in the air. And no way on God's green earth would John Kasich ever propose that, and even less likely would it be that the legislature would actually pass it. So, I mean, it's rhetoric that's just going way over the top when it comes to this. And that's what sometimes happens at these rallies, is that you take a position and move it right over, you know, jump right over the cliff with it. Now, you know, she can certainly, you know, she's come out against the bump stock ban.
She opposes anything.
So if you think bump stock should still be legal, then I guess Mary Taylor is your candidate in the primary. But I think 90% of the country has said that they don't like the bump stocks and they think they should be banned. So, you know, I don't really think that what she's saying is really factually accurate.
But it plays well at a rally, a pro gun rights rally. David and Hilliard, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. There's going to be gun rights rallies at the State House. There's going to be walkouts by students. It's been an issue for school superintendents and principals and that kind of thing around the state. How do you think Ohio school administrators are going to respond to all of this? Is this one of those kind of states that they're going to let them just show up? Or do you think there'll be the big, you know, Ivy League universities have already said they will not be, and Ohio State and all kinds of universities have said that they won't be affect their student record if they do decide to participate in a walkout. It's going to be an issue.
I think I saw a report of a Southwestern Ohio school district that was going to issue like a tardy for students who do. So, you know, in that instance, it's a penalty, but it's not something that's going to necessarily, you know, hurt their their record or their chances at success. I don't know if it would if it will prevent students from walking out.
The ACLU of Ohio has already put out guidance saying look, the school is allowed to punish you for not going to class. However, they cannot, because this is a specific issue and related to guns, they cannot punish you more because it's an organized walkout or because, you know, they can only punish you the way they would punish you any other time you may have missed a class without an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
But if they try to go further than that, you know, if they suddenly start saying we're going to suspend everyone for one day who walks out on this, then the ACLU has offered up that they will assist in those cases.
Mm-hmm. Are you expecting much action at the State House? That was it on the 24th, or is that this Wednesday?
What was this? I thought it was this week.
I think it's this week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it is Wednesday.
The
14th, right? Isn't that right?
That's what I got mixed up. Okay.
I think.
That was the 24th.
Or maybe it is.
We don't even know what day it is today.
It's coming
the 12th
up.
Today.
I know this
it's
week
the day
is
after daylight saving time. That's about all I know today.
Yeah, I know local schools in Southwest Ohio are doing things this week, and so I think a lot of our attention is being focused on what schools there are doing as opposed to the protest at the State House.
Mm-hmm.
But and kind of watching how students react to this and how teachers and administrators. My colleague also looked into whether or not you can tell whether your school allows teachers to be armed or others to be armed. And
uh-huh.
a lot of the laws surrounding school safety plans protects those from public view. And some of that's obviously you don't want the wrong person to be able to look at your school safety plan. But also it's kind of hard for a parent to know whether their teachers are armed, even if it is approved by the school board.
It is Wednesday, 10 a.m.
It's Wednesday at 10 a.m. at the State House.
Well, I think it's the national.
Oh, okay.
It's wherever you are at 10 a.m.
Okay.
For 17 minutes.
To representing each of the 17 lives that were taken
mm-hmm.
in Parkland, Florida on February 14th. What else is going on this week? We have about 2.5 minutes left. What are you guys going to be covering?
I want to give a plug to my colleague, Rich Exner, up in Cleveland. He has been looking at the gerrymandering issue, and he has a great story out this morning where he looked at the data based on 2011 and kind of came up with what a map might look like under issue one, which is going to be on the ballot on May 8th. And,
okay.
You know, what he found is that it's possible if everyone's got the right intentions to come up with a map that has maybe 5 more leaning Republican seats, 4 more leaning Democratic, just because that's where people are located. But then the rest, 6 seats being highly competitive, which is, you know, was a goal of the proposal. But it's really interesting to see kind of, you know, where he broke down the lines and you know, who's in what district. And it's certainly worth a look. It's at cleveland.com.
Okay.
I like that. I like those when you – because, yeah, because too often the legislators who've drawn these maps over the years try to make it sound like, well, this is how we had to do it.
And this is really hard.
And this is really hard.
All the stuff that we have to go through.
Right. And there's no way we could ever draw this without having to slice and dice. And
yeah.
So, yeah, I'm glad. Rich has done some really good work on this issue. I'm glad I'll have to check that story out. But, yeah, I don't know what else. To be honest, I've been on a 3-day weekend, so
I'm
a little – I know that the capital budget is going to be – getting
right.
some hearings this week, maybe some more talk about this plan to merge the Department of Education.
That's right.
I think there's a 17th hearing on the Unemployment Compensation Fund bill.
Thanks to Jim. Otherwise, we wouldn't know what hearing number we're on.
Which I think 14 of those hearings have had no witnesses, so no one's actually talking about it.
15 seconds?
Yeah.
The
capital budget, the thing I'm looking at is this $4 million for our soccer stadium infrastructure, which is a huge issue in Cincinnati. So we'll see if that goes through.
Thanks, Jesse Ballmer. Sorry about that, Jesse. Jesse Ballmer of Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks for joining us. Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks to you as well. And Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.